everybody. Now, you remember in the lecture last time we were still talking about the old right, and you'll recall the old right, despite the name right, really was a libertarian rather than a traditional European conservative movement. The European conservative movement would be pro-monarchy, pro-aristocracy, whereas the old right that Murray Rothbard is interested in consisted of people like Albert J. Nock and H.L. Mencken, who were certainly not in favor of monarchy and aristocracy. They believed in, they were against the state and in favor of the free market. So we tried to answer in the last two lectures, well, if that's the case, why do we want to call them the old right? And the answer we suggested last time was that as Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal developed from its inception in March 1933, the old right tended to ally with business groups that were opposed to the New Deal, and they became more sympathetic to people like Herbert Hoover, whom they previously criticized. Mencken had been and Nock had been very critical of Hoover, but now Hoover was one of the good guys, especially since he, in 1934, came out against the New Deal in a book called Freedom to Trade. And this alliance had another aspect to it. Not only was the old right allied with business groups that were opposed to the deal, the old right also allied with anti-war movements. In the late 1930s, Franklin Roosevelt adopted an interventionist foreign policy where it seemed, especially after his October 1937 speech in Chicago, the famous Chicago Bridge speech, it seemed that Roosevelt wanted to pursue a very active policy against Germany and Japan. And the old right figure said, no, look what happened when we got involved in World War I. America doesn't need to get involved in a new war. And here, the old right is allied with various progressive historians who were isolationists like Charles Beard and Harry Elmer Barnes. Now, once World War II started, we got to realize there was a big change in what was happening in America once the war started, especially after the German invasion of Russia, which took place on June 22, 1941. Now, America hadn't yet gotten into the war, but once Germany invaded Russia, the American Communist Party immediately started calling for America to get into the war to help the Russians. Previously, the Communists had been allied with the isolationists. And can someone tell me why would the Communists have not wanted the U.S. to get into war before the German invasion of Russia? Can anybody tell me that? Do we have any takers on that? Well, what happened was, remember, on August 23rd, 1939, Germany and Russia had signed a non-aggression pact, and then after the German invasion of Poland, September 3rd, 1939, the Russians had moved into eastern Poland September 17th, so Germany and Russia were really on the same side. Oh, what happened? My slide went off. We're on the same side. Hello? Can you still hear me? Hello, everybody?
Yes.
Something seems... Oh, good. Something seems to have gone wrong on the... Okay, I guess everything's all right. Sorry. So Germany and Russia were on the same side, so the American Communists didn't want the U.S. to get into the war against Germany and Japan, because before the Germans started attacking, then the American communists were opposed to U.S. entry into the war. But they, as soon as within a day of the German invasion of Russia, of course, the American communists shifted. And there was a group that was kind of one of the communist front organizations called the American Committee Against War and Fascism, that was one of the sort of communist front groups that was supporting isolationism. So Harry Elmer Barnes said after June 22, 1941, this group should have changed its name to the American Committee for War Against Fascism. So there was an immediate shift. So what happened after that, especially after America entered the war, the Communist Party had been very influential, very much saying the U.S. should get into the war. So after this, the American communists became very influential in the Roosevelt administration. For example, Harry Dexter White, who was an economist, was a high official of the Treasury Department, was an aide to the Secretary of the Treasury, Henry Morgenthau Jr. Turned out he was a communist spy. People in his family denied this, and he denied it, but it turned out he really was one. So he was a very highly placed person. He was a communist spy. And according to some accounts, Harry Hopkins, who was one of the most important advisors to Roosevelt, was also a communist. So the communists were doing very well. American communists were doing very well in the war. And another one who was an espionage agent, you probably heard the famous Alger Hiss case. Alger Hiss was a person who was working in the State Department later, after he was one of those responsible for setting up the conference in San Francisco that established the United Nations. So it turned out he was a spy. He was a Soviet espionage agent. And then another person who was very influential, who was sympathetic to communism, was Owen Lattimore, who was an advisor to the Chinese nationalist regime under Chiang Kai-shek. It turned out he was very sympathetic to the Chinese communists. Owen Lattimore was one of the greatest scholars on Mongolia, but he turned out he was somewhat of a communist sympathizer, although that has been disputed, but the evidence, at least the way I look at it, was that he was one. So we have the communists are doing very well in the Roosevelt administration. At the same time, during the war, as the Germans gradually were losing, the Russian army made a lot of gains in Eastern Europe. And it turned out after the war, the Russians kept the part of Poland they'd occupied in September 1939. Remember, September 17th, right after the German invasion, the Russians came in and occupied Eastern Poland. Now you might think, well, they'd gotten this when they were having the pact with the Nazis, so they shouldn't get to keep it after the war, but they did. They moved the Polish boundary westwards. They said, okay, we're taking over some Polish territory, but the Poles can then take over some German territory. And also, though, the rest of Poland, the part that the Russians hadn't taken over, was after 1945 under a communist government. The communists had expanded elsewhere in Eastern Europe. Now, during the war, as I mentioned, the United States and Russia were allies, but after the war, there was a reaction against the Soviet gains. People were saying, while we were fighting the Nazis and the Japanese, people kind of put aside their negative feelings toward Stalin and Soviet communism. But after the war, people remind themselves, look, we didn't like the Nazis, but the Soviets are also a very regime is also a very brutal dictatorship. They send people to slave labor camps, and they have purges where they kill lots of people. So they're really not great allies. So look at the end of the, that people were saying, well, look at the end of the war, look, they've made all these gains in Eastern Europe, and we have all these communists at home. So people were very upset about this. And in particular, the Republicans, and they were joined here by a lot of people on the, a lot of the old rightists, they said that Roosevelt had made unnecessary concessions at the Yalta Conference in February 1945. At this conference, Roosevelt had pretty much okayed the Russian domination of Poland. He said they made a promise to hold democratic elections, but these would be not supervised. So in effect, Roosevelt was saying, all right, we can accept the Soviet conquest in Eastern Europe. Now the critics said, well, given the progress of the Red Army, it would have been difficult to get push them out, but why did Roosevelt have to give his approval of these conquests? Maybe this was a big mistake, or so the critics said. Now, also, there was trouble in Asia. Not only had the Soviets made gains in Europe, but in Asia, there was a civil war going on since the 1930s. There was a civil war going on between Chiang Kai-shek, who was the head of the nationalist government, and the rebels, who were the Chinese communists. And it turned out in 1949, the Chinese communists were the victors in the war. And so what some of the critics of American policy said, the communist sympathizers in the State Department elsewhere were at least partially responsible for the triumph of the Chinese communists. And why was that so? Well, they said these communist sympathizers, such as Owen Lattimore, had urged all sorts of concessions on Chiang Kai-shek to the Chinese communists, and they'd been responsible for delaying American aid to Chiang Kai-shek and urging him to compromise. So the critics said, look, the American policy was undermined by the communist sympathizers who were trying to present the Chinese communists as if they were so-called agrarian reformers, were actually, they were communists who had in mind in position of a communist dictatorship. But the critics said the American policy has been undermined by communists in the State Department and elsewhere, skewing American foreign policy in a pro-Chinese communist direction. And one example of what the critics charge of the famous case, the Amerasia case. Amerasia was a magazine, kind of a left-leaning magazine, dealing with problems of Asia. And they started publishing certain documents that turned out to be classified documents. It turned out people had been, in the State Department, been giving this publication these classified documents, and the case aroused a big scandal. I think they didn't really prosecute it much because there were some legal difficulties, but a lot of the critics said, here's an example showing how the communists are trying to undermine American foreign policy. Now, you might say, well, this is all very interesting, or maybe not so interesting, but what does it have to do with the subject of our course, the old right? I mean, this is just certain people who were criticizing the Roosevelt administration for being pro-communist, or so they claim. But we have to realize that the old right people went accepted, or sometimes in the forefront of this sort of criticism of Roosevelt. The old right were ones who were saying the Roosevelt administration during World War II had been unduly influenced by communism. And why did they take this view? Well, you have to realize World War II had not been very good for the old right. The old right hadn't done very well. Because remember, they're fighting a war, so people don't want to hear from critics who say we shouldn't have gotten into the war. The Roosevelt administration is dangerously statist. Roosevelt's trying to establish a dictatorship. This wasn't what people wanted to hear during the war, and there have been moves to suppress people on the old right. For example, Garrett lost his position in the Saturday Evening Post, and he had to just write for very small magazines that didn't have very many people in them. And furthermore, Roosevelt himself and some of his supporters, like the Secretary of the Interior, Harold Ickes, smeared supporters of the old right as fascists and pro-Nazis. John T. Flynn, who was one of the key figures on the old right, wrote a pamphlet called The Smear Terror about this. There were organizations who sponsored people to infiltrate right-wing anti-interventionist organizations, published exposés on them. There was a famous book by John Roy Carlson called Undercover that pictured various critics of the New Deal as fascists. So there were a lot of people then who were attacking the old right people as fascists and Nazis. So after the war, as you can imagine, the people on the old right weren't very happy about being smeared as fascists and Nazis. So they wanted to get revenge on the people who'd done this. And what they wanted to do was they said, well, we're going to expose the communists in the government who were doing all these bad things to us. So we're going to give them back some of what they've given back to us. Harry Omer Barnes, the revisionist historian that we talked about, we'll be mentioning again, wrote a pamphlet with the title, The Chickens of the Interventionist Liberals Have Come Home to Roost. So what Barnes was saying was, look, these left-wing people are complaining about Joe McCarthy and other people investigating communists in the government, but during the war, these were the same people who were complaining, were the same people who were investigating alleged fascists. So they're just getting a dose of their own medicine. So this was a very common attitude among some people on the old right. For example, I mentioned the case of Owen Lattimore, who was an expert on Mongolia, who was an advisor to Chiang Kai-shek, who was very sympathetic to the Chinese communists. John T. Flynn wrote a book about him called The Lattimore Story, which I think is a very good book on case, saying that Lattimore was pro-communist. He had his defenders, such as Abe Fortas, who later became the Justice of the Supreme Court, but Flynn said no, these charges that were brought by Senator McCarthy against him of being pro-communist were really true. So the old right is leading the fight to say that the Roosevelt administration had been pro-communist. And people on the old right tended to be very sympathetic to Joe McCarthy's anti-communist investigation. As you probably know, Senator McCarthy is a very controversial figure. Sometimes we have the name McCarthyism is used as kind of a synonym for unfounded charges against people. But the old right didn't view it that way. They said, no, there really were communists in the State Department and elsewhere, and McCarthy might have made some mistakes, but he was basically on the right track. This is the view that Murray Rothbard held about Joe McCarthy. He was in favor of him. So the old rightists are very sympathetic to these anti-communist movements, and they're leading them, really trying to say, we've got to expose communism, communist elements in the government. Now, it's crucial to realize, though, that their old rights attempts to investigate and expose American communists did not imply that the old right was sympathetic to the Cold War. The old right wasn't saying, okay, we've got all these communists in the government, they've got to root out, and once we've done that, then we can go ahead and fight the Soviets. What the old right tends to say is, no, the danger from communism is internal. We have these communists in the government who were trying to promote socialist measures and all sorts of bad things, and they're trying to get the U.S. to aid Russia. We don't want to do that. We want to return to the traditional policy of non-intervention. So the old rightists, even though they were strongly anti-communist and were supporting trying to investigations into the influence of the communists, they were not saying we should then start fighting the Cold War about them, against them. Now, to understand what was going on in the Cold War, we have to realize that when under Harry Truman came, there's a question here. Didn't Murray later regret his support for McCarthy's project? Yes, that's a good part. There is one, I think there's one memo where he's, or a couple memos where he's very critical of McCarthy's tactics, but then there are later ones where he said he's still in favor of him. So he kind of later had kind of a mixed view. He thought McCarthy made some mistakes, but I think basically he was still sympathetic. He used to have a joke, so he's not sure he agrees with McCarthy's aims, but he certainly likes his method, because a lot of the people at the time who were critical of McCarthy would say, well, we agree with his aims, getting rid of the communists, we don't like his method. So Murray had a joke where he was kind of reversing them. But you're right, he does have some stake. There's some, at least at some times, he was quite critical of McCarthy, but then there are later ones where he went back to being in favor of him. So what Truman did, see, after the Soviets were making all these gains in Eastern Europe, in the Chinese communists, Truman said, well, he favored a policy called containment. And this meant that he thought the Soviets were held to, it should be Tbilisi, he thought the Soviets were trying to expand in Europe and they had to be stopped. So we shouldn't, on the containment, it isn't, you're not trying to kick the communists out from where they are now, but you're saying they can't go anymore. And we're not trying to get them out of Poland, let's say. If they try to take over France or Italy, we'll do things to stop them. And I think the hope was eventually, if we do that, then communism will dissolve. And the main person who provided rationale for containment was George Kennan. And he had exactly this view. He said, well, if we can just stop the communists from expanding, then communism isn't really a workable system over the long run, so it'll eventually go away or turn into something else. And notice that for Kennan, Europe was primary. He didn't say we should contain communism everywhere, like in Asia or Africa. He said it's in Europe that we have to have containment. So an example of this containment would include the Truman Doctrine, where Truman said we'll give aid to any country that's trying to, especially European countries that are trying to resist communism, and this involved aid to Greece and Turkey in 1947, and it was a Marshall Plan for reconstruction of Europe and the NATO alliance, which was an alliance of Western European nations, Britain and the U.S., to resist communism. And Dean Acheson, who became Secretary of State, the first Secretary of State under Truman's General George Marshall, Dean Acheson was the Secretary of State after them. He was a strong advocate of containment and one of the main people who put that policy into place. Now, as I mentioned before, the old right did not approve of containment. They weren't saying, well, communism is a bad thing, therefore we've got to go and prevent other nations from being communist. What their view was, the main danger from communism was internal, namely communists in the U.S. government, elsewhere, who are influencing public opinion, to adopt statists and interventionist measures. So they said, we've got to expose communism in the government so we can try to put into place measures that are more favorable to a free society. So suppose somebody said to them, well, but look, don't we have to go against communism in other nations as well? Isn't it better if we can stop Poland or even Russia itself from being communist? So people like Garrett and John T. Flynn thought this is exactly the same kind of argument people use to say we ought to resist the Germans. And they said, no, if we do that, if we try to overthrow or resist communism elsewhere, this will just lead to a militarized American society, an increasingly powerful state. We don't want to do that. We want to have a free society based on free market and very limited government. So we don't want to expand the Defense Department to massive proportions to try to overthrow other governments. We need to just have enough defense to preserve America from attack. If we try to do more, we'll just be leading to interventionism and militarism. Okay, now Danny just has another comment. We said domestic red baiting. Yes, that is a very good word, very strongly opposed to red baiting. I think especially what he had in mind there was government investigations that were violating people's civil liberties. But even after that, he wrote that he still made statements in conversation that were pretty friendly to McCarthy. But you're right, he does make that statement. So I think it would certainly be wrong to say that he was always pro Joe McCarthy. Yes, so thank you for mentioning that. Now, this part about an increasingly militarized society, which would follow if we had a interventionist policy, was a concern of a leading ally of the old right in Congress, who was Senator Robert Taft of Ohio. Remember, he was the son of President William Howard Taft, and he was a candidate for president in various years. I think first in 1940 he was seeking Republican nomination, and he was seeking it at various every time since then. And a lot of the old rightists supported him, especially in 1952, and he never got it, but he came close. So Taft was very much aware of this possible danger of militarism if we had an interventionist foreign policy. And he was opposed to the NATO alliance. He said, we shouldn't align with these other European nations. We should just be more concerned with protecting America. And other opponents of containment and aggressive foreign policy were Herbert Hoover, the former president, who, remember, he had been an opponent of U.S. entry into World War II, and he continued to oppose an interventionist foreign policy after the war. He thought we shouldn't have a policy of trying to stop the communists in Europe. We should have more defensive foreign policy. In Joseph Kennedy, who had been the American ambassador to England before the war and was an opponent of American entry into the war, he also opposed containment. Rothbard quotes in the Trail of American Right some speeches by Kennedy where he was strongly opposing American foreign policy. So, you know, what was the relation between Joseph Kennedy and President Kennedy? Does anybody know that? Yes, actually, yes, that was his father. So these were people who were opposed to the containment policy. Now, when the Korean War broke out, excuse me, in June 1950, President Truman deliberately didn't ask Congress for a declaration of war. Remember, in World War II, Roosevelt did ask for a declaration of war. Probably most of you have heard, you could watch it on YouTube, the famous speech for December 8th, where Roosevelt calls for a declaration of war, in the famous speech. Yesterday, December 7th, a date which will live in infamy. It's one of the most famous speeches. So, in that respect, Roosevelt was following the Constitution, because the Constitution says that Congress has the power to declare war. The president can't get us into a war just on his own. But Truman didn't ask Congress for a declaration of war. He could probably have gotten one if he'd asked, but he didn't. And instead, he claimed he was acting under the authority of the United Nations. Remember, the United Nations had been set up after the war. And so he said he's following the treaty of the United Nations that says that we have a country should resist aggression. So he's following the United Nations. He asked for the United to vote in the United Nations. Now, for the old right, surrender of American sovereignty was a vital issue, and Taft denounced Truman because he violated the Constitution on declaration of war. Taft said, if you want to go to war in Korea, you should have come to Congress and asked for declaration of war. It's somewhat like Ron Paul on the Iraq War. Just as Ron Paul was saying, look, Bush shouldn't have just invaded Iraq or invaded Afghanistan. You need a congressional declaration of war, and he didn't get one. Taft said exactly that about the Korean War, that you need to have a declaration of war. Now, so in addition to this activity with the old right where they're questioning American foreign policy, one thing that was also going on at a time of former people on this old right alliance were the revisionist historians who were led by Harry Elmer Barnes. Remember, I talked about him previously. He was the one who wrote the Genesis of the World War in 1926, which was questioning the view that Germany had been for exclusive responsibility for World War I. So these revisionist historians tried to start a popular movement against World War II, just like the revisionist movement after World War I. You remember, I mentioned in the earlier lectures that when the revisionists like Barnes and Sidney Fay started writing their books, they weren't just narrowly academic books that only professional historians were interested in. They acquired a wide popular following, and partly as a result of this, it certainly wasn't the only reason, but people generally in America in the 1930s had the view we shouldn't have participated in the war. We should have really stayed out. We made a big mistake. So the revisionists were hoping if they started publishing books that challenged the official account of World War II, then people would say, we made another mistake. We should have stayed out of the war again. So now we should learn our lesson and get back to a non-interventionist foreign policy. And they published a lot of important books at the time. For example, George Morgenstern, who was worked for the Chicago Tribune. Remember, the Chicago Tribune under Colonel Robert McCormick was one of the main newspaper, probably the main newspaper in America defending an old right position. He wrote a book called Pearl Harbor, The Story of the Secret War, which claimed that Roosevelt had really was aware that the Japanese were going to attack Pearl Harbor, but had deliberately withheld the information because he wanted to get us into the war in Europe. And he knew that if the Japanese attacked, then we would get involved in the war. Another book with a similar thesis, one of the most thoroughly documented books on World War II, was by the Charles Tansel called Back Door to War. Remember, he had written the most important book on American entry into the war, America Goes to War, in 1938. So he now wrote 1952, Back Door to War, which was a long survey of American foreign policy based on very detailed research into the State Department archive. And then also the leading American historian of the time, Charles Beard, wrote a book, kind of strong book on Pearl Harbor revisionism called President Roosevelt and the Coming of the War. And then also, last one I'll mention, there was an anthology, or a collection of essays edited by Barnes called Perpetual War for Perpetual Peace that contained contributions by most of the leading revisionists. So these were very important books, but they didn't get the wide attention the World War I books had gotten. And one of the reasons for this, that they didn't get so much attention, was there was a very active campaign against these revisionist books. For example, the Council on Foreign Relations, which was a group that still exists studying foreign policy, was a successor, actually, to Woodrow Wilson's Council of Experts. It was a group of people he got together that helped in the preparation of the Treaty of Versailles. This council sponsored a two-volume work by the historians William L. Langer and S. Everett Gleason. And their work was specifically designed to head off a revisionist movement. And according to the report of the Rockefeller Foundation, 1946, that the council was concerned that, to quote them, that the debunking journalistic campaign following World War I should not be repeated. So they wanted to try to stop this by having a book, this very massively documented book, to try to give a defense of the Roosevelt administration's position. And the Rockefeller Foundation gave Langer and Gleason a grant of $139,000 for research, when in those days it was an enormous amount of money. And they got privileged access to the State Department documents when they were doing this research. So what we've discussed so far, we really discussed two policy options. We've discussed the Truman policy of containment and the old Reich policy, or opposition to the Cold War, and included within this old Reich policy, these revisionist historians saying we shouldn't have gotten into World War II. Now, there's another policy alternative besides containment and non-intervention. And some people thought that U.S. foreign policy wasn't going far enough. The view was, well, why should we stop at containment, which is saying the Soviets shouldn't be allowed to go any further. The other view was that Soviet conquest should be rolled back. They should push them out of where they were, even if doing so required a preventive war. Remember, a preventive war is one where instead of waiting for the other side to attack you, you attack them. You say, they're going to attack us, so we're going to get them first. So there are some people who said, well, we should really launch a preventive war against Russia. The communists are determined to destroy us, so we've got to get to them first. And among the people who favored preventive war were many ex-communists, many people who one time favored communism now said, well, we were wrong, communism isn't good, it's really horribly evil, and we've got to do absolutely everything to get rid of it, including starting a nuclear war if necessary. For example, one such person was Billy Schlamm, who was a very influential editor who worked for Henry Luce. Henry Luce was the founder of the various American magazines, Time, Life, and Fortune, which in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s were extremely influential. So Schlamm was a former German communist who was calling for preventive nuclear war. And another was Frank S. Meyer, who'd been an official of the U.S. Communist Party. And then another one who was calling, was looking favorably on preventive war was James Burnham, who'd been a former Trotskyite, father of Leon Trotsky. And why do I mention these? Well, all of these became editors of National Review magazine, which we'll be discussing shortly, which I'll be discussing more in the lecture next week. So these people retain some of the images of world struggle that they had learned while communists, so just as the communists were talking about a world revolution, they continued to have that image of kind of a world struggle. They want to now have a world struggle against communism. For example, Whitaker Chambers, I think I misspelled his name, it has two T's in it, who exposed Alger Hiss as a communist spy, viewed the Cold War as a conflict between the forces of God and the forces of Satan. So this was really a religious struggle for him. And you can, if you want to read his book, his autobiography called Witness, you can see it's somewhat kind of a, just like a Dostoevsky novel, it had this very theological theme of we're struggling against the powers of evil. Now, this view that was sympathetic to preventive war had some support in the U.S. military and the CIA, especially before Russia exploded an aid bomb in 1949. After that, now once the Russians had nuclear weapons of their own, there tended to be less support for preventive war in government circles, although there were still some. One example would be Curtis LeMay, who was the head of the Strategic Air Command, very sympathetic to preventive war. And James Burnham, who I mentioned before, the former Trotskyite who favored preventive war, worked for the CIA. And another person was a very influential editor at National Review named Wilmore Kendall, also worked for the CIA. And like Burnham, Kendall had once been a Trotskyite. So what we have is a number of people who were former communists, or either Stalinists or Trotskyite, who some of whom had connections with the CIA, who were saying, we've got to have a preventive war against Russia. We should at least take that possibility, take that option seriously. So now we have to say, where does William Buckley, who was the founder of National Review, come into all this? Well, Buckley was the son of a very wealthy oil man, and this father was a friend of Albert J. Nock, who we talked about before. And Buckley, as a young man, William F. Buckley, the son, was very influenced by Nock, and he started out with libertarian sympathies. And for a while, he was a disciple of the libertarian Frank Chodorov. We talked about Chodorov, remember? Chodorov and Rothbard was knew each other when Rothbard was also very influenced by Chodorov. And Chodorov at Buckley set up a group called the Intercollegiate Society of Individualists, which was designed to promote a libertarian policy. So Buckley was someone who was starting off as a libertarian, not strict libertarian, but someone at least with strong libertarian sympathies. Now, Buckley attracted very wide attention with his first book, which was called God and Man at Yale. Buckley had been a student at Yale. He was the head of the debate team, and he'd done very well there. And what he did in that book was he attacked professors at Yale who were anti-free market and also professors who were anti-Christian. He said there was a lot of religious skepticism and opposition to the free market, and he didn't like either one. He was very sympathetic to the free market. He's also very strongly religious. He was a devout Catholic. So he wrote a book saying Yale is really having all these bad left-wing professors who are trying to undermine our economic system, and they're also promoting skepticism about religion. Now, the key point, though, to understand what happened to Buckley is, although he had these libertarian sympathies, he was also a strong proponent of a Cold War against the Soviets. And he thought that the struggle against the Soviets was so important that we had to put aside libertarianism for the duration of the Cold War. He said, well, ideally we should have knock this right. We need to drastically reduce it, not get rid of the state altogether. We can't do this while we're fighting the Cold War. And in 1952, he wrote in Commonweal magazine. Commonweal is a magazine for it's kind of a liberal Catholic magazine. He said, we have to accept big government for the duration, meaning the duration of the Cold War. For neither an offensive nor defensive war can be waged, given our present government skills, except through the instrument of a totalitarian bureaucracy within our shores. It might be that Soviet power is a menace to our free. If people see Soviet power as a menace to our freedom, as I happen to, they will have to support large armies and air forces, atomic energy, central intelligence, war production board, and the attendant of centralization of power in Washington, even with Truman at the reins of it all. So what Buckley's saying here, he was personally very disdainful of Truman, and he considered a vulgar person, but he said, well, we even have to put up with Truman because we have to win the Cold War. So what basically Buckley was saying was, Taft and the other old rightists have a point that if we have an interventionist policy fighting the Soviets in the Cold War, then we're going to have a militarized society, big government. But he said that isn't sufficient reason to abandon the Cold War. On the contrary, we have to accept this as a consequence. Well, we do have to fight the Cold War, so we need to have militarism. We need to put up with militarism. So you see, it's just like in logic, Taft is saying, if we fight the Cold War, then we'll have militarism, but we don't want militarism, so we shouldn't fight the Cold War. Buckley's just saying it, taking it the other way, if we fight the Cold War, then we'll have militarism, but we do have to fight the Cold War, therefore we have to put up with militarism. So one person is agreeing on the consequences of fighting the Cold War, but one is saying, well, given these consequences, we shouldn't fight the Cold War. The other position is, we should fight the Cold War, so we have to put up with the consequences. Now, Buckley had also been working for the CIA, worked for the CIA for 2 years, and for part of these 2 years, his boss was E. Howard Hunt, who was later famous as one of Nixon's Watergate burglars. Now, Buckley set up National Review magazine in 1955. Now, we don't have positive proof that the CIA was behind this, but we do know that the CIA subsidized magazines to help promote American foreign policy in the Cold War. For example, it came out that there was a British magazine, kind of very high quality intellectual magazine called Encounter, and it turned out that this magazine got CIA subsidies. So it seems to me, given that Buckley had been in the CIA, and Burnham and Kendall were editors of the magazine, been in the CIA, it's not very, it's quite plausible to think the CIA was backing this magazine. And in fact, a friend of mine who knew Henry Regnery, who was the publisher of many conservative books, who also had CIA connection, told me that Regnery had said to him he suspected that National Review was really a CIA operation. Now, Buckley himself agreed with Burnham, James Burnham was the main foreign policy figure in the magazine. Other people wrote on foreign policy, but Burnham was the main one, the most important person. So Buckley agreed that the U.S. should risk nuclear war in order to liberate the world from communism. So he had one argument that he tended to stress a great deal. Is suppose somebody said, well, we shouldn't risk nuclear war because if a nuclear war breaks out, it could lead to enormous millions of people would be killed if we had a nuclear war. So we should really avoid nuclear war at all costs. So Buckley said, well, if you think like that, if you say that, then you're really displaying an atheistic and materialistic attitude. If you're really concerned with the struggle against atheistic communism, which is a threat to our souls, we should willingly accept death if this is needed to wipe out communism. So Buckley would say, there was a slogan, better red than dead. Buckley would say, better dead than red. We should really be willing to give up our lives in this struggle. So if one said to Buckley, as Rothbard would, well, what the policy you're proposing risks killing millions and millions of people, Buckley would say, it's worth it. The struggle against communism really is so important that we should be willing to give up our lives in its pursuit. Now, anyone who wrote for National Review who disagreed with this, you would be purged from the magazine. Now, there were some people who wrote for National Review who didn't have favor that such a policy of an all-out policy of nuclear war. For example, Russell Kirk, who is the author of the famous book, The Conservative Mind, which was one of the main books leading to revival of conservatism after World War II, did not favor this kind of a very aggressive foreign policy. And Richard Weaver, who is a professor of English at the University of Chicago, author of the book Ideas Have Consequences, is also opposed to bellicose foreign policy. Weaver has very good essays on the dangers of war, but he didn't write much on foreign policy. The people who did write on foreign policy in the magazine tended to be very bellicose people saying we should really let the communists have it. And Buckley, even though John T. Flynn was a very respected figure among the people who were writing the American conservatives in the 1950s, American Right, Buckley wouldn't publish an article by Flynn that was very critical of the Cold War. Now, Buckley and Murray Rothbard knew each other quite well, and Buckley had Rothbard wrote a number of articles and reviews for Buckley's magazine, mostly on economics. And in fact, at that time, we'll see later this change, most of the contributors who wrote on economics, who included Henry Hazlitt, supported the free market, although James Burnham, William Kendall, really CIA agents, allowed a lot of government intervention. Ernest Vondenhagen, who was a psychoanalyst, who was also wrote for National Review, was a Keynesian. He was also one of the contributors to National Review, wasn't favorable to the free market very much. But most of the ones who wrote in the 1950s wrote economics were, like Rothbard, sympathetic to the free market. Vondenhagen, incidentally, in 1979, published a big attack on the Cato Institute, not Rothbard. It was an article in June 79, so he was always hostile to the libertarian groups. And another one who wrote on Free National Review was Whitaker Chambers. Remember I mentioned him, the ex-communist who viewed the struggle as communism as a religious struggle. He attacked, in a famous review of Atlas Shrugged, he attacked Ayn Rand. He said when he read her book, he had the feeling on every page he was hearing the message to a gas chamber go, from saying she was really a totalitarian. And he also attacked Mises. He wrote Buckley a very negative letter about Mises' book, The Anti-Capitalist Mentality. Now, as I say, Rothbard and Buckley knew each other, and in fact, when Buckley was writing his book, a book called Up From Liberalism, Rothbard helped him with some research on economics texts, so they were on pretty friendly terms. However, they split when Nikita Khrushchev, who was the head of the Russian, who was first secretary of the Communist Party, kind of a Russian leader, dictator in the period after Stalin's death, a few years after, to the early 60s. He visited the U.S. in 1959. Buckley was strongly opposed to this visit. He said, well, Khrushchev is a mass murderer. He was involved in all sorts of purges in the Ukraine. So people really shouldn't be allowed to visit, and we should have nothing to do with him. And Rothbard certainly wasn't sympathetic to Khrushchev's crimes, but he welcomed the visit as a step toward peace. So after that, after they quarreled about that, Rothbard stopped contributing to the magazine. So now next week, what I'm going to do, I'm going to continue to talk about National Review. And next week, we'll talk about in more detail about some of the ideas of influential editors of National Review, in particular James Burnham, Wilmer Kendall, and Frank Meyer. Okay, so I think now we'll have the rest of the time for questions and discussion. Now, yes, I was thinking, that quotation from Rothbard is very interesting on McCarthy. I mean, perhaps I would say it was certainly true at the time that the old Reich figures tended to support McCarthy, but I think Rothbard, at least in what he said, Betrayal of the American Right, does seem to have regretted that, although, as I say, there are statements he made at other times where he still seems to basically agree with McCarthy. But I think what he basically differed with was using the government to investigate these people instead of just getting rid of the government jobs, as he said. But, well, so we'll open it to questions, comments, objections. Let's see, here's a question. Do you remember who it was at Center Review Media's The Uncapitalist Mentality? It was Know Nothingism, Know Nothingness. Well, I have to check, but that might have been Chambers who said that, but I'd have to check that. You know, Chambers was very, hostile to the book. And actually, I think the book is a very good examination of sociology of anti-capitalism. I think it's a bit hard on detective novels, but I mean, other than that, it seems like I think it's a very well done book. But Whitaker Chambers and the author of this review, if it's different from Chambers, certainly didn't agree. See, here's something else here. Jeff said, Rothbard opposed the Cold War because he thought communism was doomed. Why didn't Moore agree with him? Well, I think, of course, George Kennan thought that also, but I think some people thought, well, even if communism can't, there are two things here. Some people thought even if communism can't win in the long run, they could really take over all sorts of countries and ruin things for other people. Then maybe they would collapse eventually, but what about all the people they took over? Now, another thing, which is a lot of people who were post-communists, didn't think that communism was doomed. They thought communism was doing pretty well. Remember, Paul Samuelson can take very seriously the Soviet claims that they would be surpassing American production. Remember, the Soviet plan was they were going to forget about consumer standards for the duration, we're going to put everything into capital goods. And some people took very seriously their claims, well, if they did that, they'd eventually surpass American production. So they didn't think the Soviets were going to collapse. Now let's see, somebody else, yes, okay, Andrew says, I've heard some otherwise where good libertarians and anarchists reject Rothbard, saying it's foolish to believe the Soviet Union posed no threat whatsoever to the U.S. Granted that the internal threat was greater, is that a fair assessment of Rothbard's view of the USSR? Well, I don't think he took the view that there were no circumstances in which the Soviets could pose a threat to the U.S., but he thought that after World War II, Soviet foreign policy was primarily defensive. Their view was they made certain gains in Eastern Europe and elsewhere. They wanted to make sure nobody took those gains away from them. So, I mean, he didn't just say, for example, if you look at the memo to Frank Meyer that I put in the reading list, he didn't just say, well, we should just throw away all our weapons, but he favored a mutual disarmament. So I don't think he's saying, oh, we have to, you know, we just should believe everything the Russians are saying. But in his view, they were primarily interested in consolidating their own position rather than in attacking us. And he tended in his analysis of particular events like the Korean War and other things. He tended to think that the communists were primarily defensive and that there were a lot of American foreign policy was more aggressive, the same way we remember America was much, turned out later, America was much more powerful than the Soviets, so he thought the American policy was much more aggressive than the Soviets weren't so aggressive. Andy says, maybe it is early, but Buckley started the Young Americans for Freedom. Is this also a neocon organization? What about Young Americans for Liberty? This covered later that the question passed. Well, I wasn't sure. Young Americans for Freedom was not a neocon group. It was more, they were kind of a split. They were kind of a group of people who were kind of readers. People would read, young people would read National Review. And at the time, that included some people were libertarians. So there was a split within Young Americans for Freedom where there was a the libertarian group kind of was very badly received by other people in the group who were more in favor of an aggressive policy. See, Young Americans for Freedom was very involved in the 1964 campaign of Barry Goldwater for president. I remember that very well myself because I was in high school at the time. And at that time, Rothbard was opposed to Goldwater because of his very aggressive foreign policy. But at that time, a lot of free market supporters thought, well, Goldwater's really good. We've got to support him. So the Young Americans for Freedom people tend to support Goldwater, but then there was a split between the libertarian ones that, look, we've got to have the free market, and not really the pursuit of the Cold War is really not something we should do, or if at least it's of secondary significance, and the others who said, no, Cold War is the real big thing, much more important than the free market. So there was a split there. Good. So we still have some time for more questions. Let's see, here's one. Jeff, is there any way to confirm CIA involvement in funding the National Bureau of Freedom of Info Act? Well, it would probably be possible to find out, if someone were to investigate, it would probably to find out. And, I mean, imagine many documents would be classified, but we do know one thing I should have mentioned in the lectures, is that I think very important, I should have mentioned this, I just overlooked it, is that one, the person who, the attorney who set up the incorporation papers for National Review was William J. Casey, who was, I think, the head of the CIA at one time. He and Buckley were very good friends. I mean, he had also been involved in the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, during World War II. So, I mean, we know that high CIA people were involved at the highest levels in National Review. And we do know also the CIA was funding various magazines. So I think we have at least good reason to believe that the CIA was involved. Yes. Andrew reminded Casey was Reagan's CIA chief. Yes, I mean, he was very much involved in American intelligence from starting in, from the World War II period going on for a long time. I remember he was a guest on Buckley's TV show. I should say Buckley also, remember I mentioned the Council on Foreign Relations, this group that was trying to stop the revisionist campaign after World War II. Buckley became a member of that group. It's kind of an establishment group. So it was kind of a contradictory, at least a tension in Buckley's thinking, that he started off that National Review was supposed to be an sort of a magazine that was very critical of the way American policy was conducted. Remember, God and Man at Yale, they say Yale University, which was one of the most important universities of the American elite, what really was anti-market and anti-Christian. So he comes off as someone who's very much a rebel against the government and intellectual leaders. But he himself really had very strong ties to people in the government, and he wanted to be friends with them. So he was really kind of, although he acted sometimes as a critic of the ruling powers, he was really wanted to be one of them also. So there is that strong tension in Buckley's activities and thinking. Let's see here something. Did Rothbard get along personally with Buckley? They seem like they have clashing personalities. Well, from talking to Rothbard, I think he didn't know Buckley extremely well. He would see him at various National Review parties. But I think he did get along with him until they had this quarrel over the Khrushchev visit. I think Buckley respected Rothbard as an economist, and I think he was impressed with him. And I don't think Rothbard thought all that Bush's articles, but I don't think he ever regarded Buckley as a close friend. And he says, do you know of any current publication who is supported by the CIA or CIA front? No, I mean, that would require some investigation. I would suspect, I mean, I could just take a guess. I think if you look at the New Republic magazine would be one. It wouldn't surprise me if they had CIA funding, but that's just a guess based on their foreign policies they advocate. But, you know, there are other publications like Foreign Affairs, of course, published by the Council on Foreign Relations. I mean, I think it wouldn't surprise me if these got funding, but again, I don't know that. I don't have any evidence on that, but I'll tell you, when we talked about Joe McCarthy earlier, remember when the powers that the American government, like especially Eisenhower and Congress, when they turned against McCarthy, that what was he planning to investigate just when they turned against him? It was the CIA. So, I mean, this is a very touchy area. If you start investigating the CIA, you can get into big trouble. Okay, now there's something from Charles. I should send to all participants also. Sorry, I guess Cam hasn't been. I didn't write anything, so. Doesn't really matter. Oh, here's one here. Maggie says, would you consider Hazlitt as a member of the old right? Did he express views on matters of U.S. foreign policy and many strict economic issues? Well, he mainly wrote on economics, but he was not really an old rightist in foreign policy. He tended to be very sympathetic to England. For example, in 1956, remember the British, French, and Israelis invaded Egypt. You know, when Egypt nationalized the Suez Canal, and Britain, France, and Israel invaded. So Hazlitt supported the British. So he was not a He didn't write much on foreign policy, but he tended to be very sympathetic to British foreign policy. But he was one thing he did write on foreign policy, he was very much opposed to foreign aid. He opposed the Marshall Plan and the Point Four economic program. So he was very opposed to foreign aid. But I don't think he wrote much on foreign policy other than that. Jeff says, Charles, the question, since Rothbard, Frank Meyer, Gary Wills all believe that National View had strong CIA connections, do you believe we can say that because of the central role of Buckley and NR in the formation of the new right, that the modern conservative movement was essentially a synthetic creation of American intelligence the past 55 years been set based on a set of noble lies? Yes, I think one could go, that would be, I think one could say that. I mean, that what they were doing was really trying to make sure that those who were kind of sympathetic to the old right didn't go in that direction. We'll see in the lecture next week, they purged more people who did. For example, the John Birch Society, which was a very strongly anti-communist group that was also opposed to, they were opposed to the Vietnam War. So Buckley got rid of them. He said, oh, these are dangerous extremists. And so I think you're quite right in suggesting that they were, it was certain elements like in the CIA and other people in the American state who were kind of making sure that the right wing so-called opposition really went in the directions they wanted. What was Buckley, Andy said, what was Buckley's relationship with Goldwater? Well, Buckley, of course, knew Goldwater, and the magazine supported him, but Buckley wasn't that personally close to Goldwater, and I think he was rather critical of the way he conducted his campaign. Burnham, J. Burnham, was actually sympathetic to Nelson Rockefeller rather than Goldwater, so Buckley, so the magazine was really running a lot of pro-Goldwater articles, but Buckley himself wasn't really that personally close, and he certainly didn't play an active role in the campaign. The publisher of National Review was named William Rusher, R-U-S-H-E-R, was very close to Goldwater and did play an active role in the campaign, but not Buckley himself. Buckley was much closer to Ronald Reagan than he was to Goldwater. Now, just as I remember in an obituary of Ayn Rand, Buckley referred to her philosophy as stillborn. Oh, yes, you see, Buckley really didn't like Ayn Rand at all. And as you can surmise from what I said about Buckley and his position on the Cold War, where I said Buckley thought that we should be willing to die to defend America, because really, a material existence really isn't that important. See, Buckley tended to view the world as extremely devout Catholic, where the spiritual dimension is really primary. And since Rand was an atheist and someone who was saying, really, there isn't anything higher than our self-interest, this would be really an alien idea to Buckley. Remember, when that review that I mentioned by Whitaker Chambers came out, where he was saying he saw on every, heard on every page of Atlas Shrugged a message to a gas chamber go. Exactly, Ralph Rako, some of you know, published a, sent in a very critical letter about that review. You know, it's kind of a stupid thing to say on Chambers' part. I mean, Rand and what she might have been very intolerant of people criticizing her, and she wanted things a certain way, but she was a supporter of a free society. It's certainly very unfair to picture her as a proto-totalitarian. But after that review was published, Ayn Rand really would have nothing to do with Buckley, and she really didn't like him, and he didn't like her. Let's see, here's another question. Jeff says, do you think the NRCIA connection is known by the current staff at NR? My guess would be that it is. I mean, this information was publicized by some of the critics of Buckley. There was a book by Jeff McManus of the John Birch Society, had a book on Buckley, and it's come out in various articles on I think on the Rockwell page and elsewhere. So, I mean, I don't think it's very secret. I mean, it was well known at the time, and people, it, they didn't, people in National Review didn't keep secret that Burnham and Kendall and Buckley himself had worked for the CIA. That wasn't a secret at all. They were very proud of that. So I don't think it would come as a surprise to people. And someone said, and he said, what was Goldwater's foreign policy? Was he non-interventionist? Or, no, he was definitely not a non-interventionist. Remember, at 1952 Republican convention, Goldwater was an Eisenhower supporter, not a supporter of Robert Taft, who was the non-interventionist candidate. So Goldwater's policy was really, we should be willing, I mean, he was quite sympathetic to being willing to risk nuclear war. For example, he favored an invasion of Cuba to get rid of Castro. There used to be a joke going around that if Goldwater were elected, his inaugural address would be 10, 9, 8, 7. But, you know, I mean, that might have been an unfair criticism, but he was definitely, he favored really waging the Cold War in a very aggressive fashion. So he was, that was why Rothbard wouldn't support him in 64, even though he had free market views domestically. I think I mentioned this before, but I'll tell you the story again. But I asked, when I was in high school, I asked Harry Elmer Barnes what he was going to, what about, who was he supporting in the 64 election? And he said, as my old friend Henry Mencken once said, I think I'll sit this one out. Now, Justin said, Rothbard's review of Kendall's lecture on the Democratic Society was shockingly perceptive, even from someone as intelligent as Rothbard. Are you going to discuss it more in depth next week? Yes, that's one of the main topics I'm going to be discussing. See, I'm going to give the lecture next week a little more intellectual history. We'll be going through Kendall's ideas and Burnham and also probably Frank Meyer as well. So that'll be that lecture is going to be one of the main topics of that I'm going to be talking about next week. I'm glad you liked that lecture. I thought it was extremely good also. I mean, Rothbard's review of Kendall's lecture, I should say. Okay, here's something. Charles says, NR's Jonah Goldberg's mother, Lucianne Goldberg, famous because of her connection to Monica Lewinsky, is said to be very connected to American intelligence. I think this is why he is at National Review. He's not a talented writer. Well, that's very interesting. You know, I did a, Jonah Goldberg had a review, had a book on liberal fascism. I think illustrates exactly what you were suggesting, Charles, what you were suggesting earlier, where kind of the CIA is trying to divert the American right, because he gives in that book kind of a view that would be very sympathetic. People sort of from our point of view would first seem very sympathetic to, namely that certain policies of the American left are really fascist, similar to fascism and having a big role for the state. But the way he kind of twists this around in that direction, I think shows some influence by non-libertarian communism. He doesn't apply this to foreign policy at all. A very interventionist foreign policy is fine with him. So he's really trying to take kind of libertarian criticism of economic interventionism, it says this is kind of a fascist form of socialism. He's saying, well, this is right, but he's not applying it to foreign policy. Of course, in the book, as I tried to bring out my review of it, he makes a lot of mistakes about particular things. I think he discusses a speech by the German philosopher Martin Heidegger where he got exactly wrong what Heidegger was saying. he thought Heidegger was favoring the destruction of the European tradition, and Heidegger was talking about preserving the classics rather than opposing. Of course, there's a lot one could criticize him, Heidegger, but he really didn't understand what he was saying at all. See, here's something. Do you have any involvement with Rothbard's various political activism? I was aware of various things when Rothbard was involved. I wasn't really involved politically much myself. I was just around, and he would tell me various things that were happening. But I didn't get really involved in it too much myself. I'm more of a I did more writing, kind of a somewhat academic kind, but I didn't really get involved in things politically that much. Carlos, yes, that's right. That was funny. Leonard Lidgew. I knew him. I don't know him well, but I did know him. Well, does anyone have any last question? I think we're about out of time, but if anyone has a last question. Robert Leno said your conversation with Rothbard must have been epic. Were they? Well, I got a lot from, Rothbard really knew an enormous amount about things. I always learned from him, so I really learned a great deal in the conversations with Rothbard, and he knew on all sorts of topics. It would always be good to hear what he had to say about them. So I really did enjoy talking to him a great deal. I learned an enormous amount from him. Well, all right. Well, thanks, everybody. So, and next week we're going to talk about some of the more in detail about some of the main writers for National Review. We'll go into their ideas and Rothbard's criticisms, and to read more from a more intellectual history point of view. Thank you, everybody. Hope to see you all next week. Bye.